The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This format is going to be more or less the format for most of the classes in this course, the Jewish Books course. I'm interested in terms of goals. A lot of people come here and they get a chance to sort of, you know, get a little deeper into what Judaism is. And then they leave and they say, okay, now what do? You know, there's all this information. It seems that all these people giving us this information got it out of Jewish books. Well, where do I begin? So one of my goals is that you should have a little bit, you know, obviously it takes a lot longer. I taught a class on this particular topic, how to study Torah, how to study Chumash, twice a week for 2 hours for a year. And I told them in yeshiva, obviously, we're not going to cover everything in a year. So it goes without saying that in the space of an hour or two, we're not going to cover the topic. But I want to whet your appetite. If you walk out of here with a desire to get more of a sense of the particular book that we're covering in this class, and in general, to pursue study, which I think is a magnificent thing, then I'll be happy. And I hope that at least a little bit, I can perhaps give you some rudimentary tools and skills in how to do this. You know, I had a student here, and I'm always curious as to how students arrive at Israelite, because some of the stories and journeys that people are, you know, we're all on a journey. And some of the paths that our journeys take before we all happen to end up in the same spot are amazing in their variety. So I was talking to this one particular student, and it was interestingly enough not long before I ended up teaching this course, which was valuable for me. But he said, you know, I was sitting in a class, and I was about as remotely related to Judaism as a person can be and still know that he's a Jew. And there was a speaker, and a friend of mine said, you got to come hear the speaker. He's great, he's a rabbi, whatever. And I thought, you know, what am I going to go listen to a rabbi? I mean, it didn't sound like a great night out. But he said, you know, I don't even remember how I ended up there. I must have really had a boring night planned. So I went to hear this rabbi. And there was one line that this rabbi said that really got to me. He said, this rabbi said, you know, we're called the people of the book. I mean, that's what we're called, right? We're called the people of the book. How many people ever opened the book? It's true. How many people know what the book is? How many people know how to use the book? How to look through the book, what the book means. Develop a relationship with that book. So I think that's a very valuable commentary. And if nothing else, I'd love to give you a sense of what this book is. Now, before we get to more technical, and obviously this type of a class is going to have both its technical and its philosophical side, and I'm very interested in getting a chance to get into some text and have some fun with you. Well, I'll have fun. Whether you will, you'll have to judge. What do you think this is? This book, by the way, Torah, is really three parts. The Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim, the five books of Moses, that's the Torah, the writings and the prophets. I'll get to this a little later. We're splitting this up into two units, really. The prophets, we're going to get to the next time I teach this class. We're talking about the first five books, the Mosaic, but we're calling that the Torah for now. So what do you think the Torah is? I mean, it's not a medical book, right? So what is it? I mean, we're all Jews. We're here to study Torah. So what is the Torah? What do you think it is?
A guideline.
Okay. I'll go with that. A guideline to what? The living life, okay?
I mean, everything that involves your relationships and study. Because, I mean, I'm taking that from this book.
A book of growth through Torah, okay.
Taking all of this from the Torah, and it's just
okay.
Everything.
Okay, a book of life. This, by the way, is an excellent book, since you bring it up, Growth Through Torah by Rabbi Zelig Bliskin, right? Who is himself an amazing individual. But that's a story for another time. He has a few incredible books. But okay, what else? Book of what? Yeah.
The book of Holy Scriptures.
Well, what's a Holy Scripture? I mean, does that mean that, like, when you open it, it sort of floats a little, like, woo?
Some,
you know, or
it's
full of
meaning and truth and...
A book of truth.
And history
Now this is interesting. A book of truth, a book of life. What else? Am I not paraphrasing you properly? If I okay, yeah.
It's a history.
History.
It's an educational manual. For
educational manual. Well, for rabbis, now that's interesting.
Well, parts of it are probably going into more detail than the average.
I will tell you, by the way, just as an aside. Maybe this is a discussion for another time, but I will tell you as an aside. You know, when I was in Lebanon, so I was fascinated by the Druzin. There's a whole people that came out of the northern, originally probably from the area of Syria and Babylonia, but they're called Druzin. They have a very secret religion. And without going into all the details, the priests are the only ones who know really the entirety of the religion. It's not taught to the masses because it's too holy. Judaism doesn't believe in that at all. Judaism believes that this book is open to everyone. It's just a question of, you know, who will take the time to study it. What makes one person a rabbi is simply that they had the desire to study more. And they therefore become accepted by others as knowing more. Or we're going to get into maybe even being more. Or being someone I want to emulate. Right? But the book is open. And there's nothing in here that is for me that isn't for you, or that is for the Maimonides that isn't for you, but I assume you realize that. You're just, right?
Right.
Okay. No, I realize it. But you gave me an excuse to make a comment. What about mitzvot? Isn't it a book of laws? Right? I mean, you're talking about a book of life.
And, guidelines
for life. Pardon? Guidelines for life. So it's also a book of guidelines.
I believe that it's from God, that it isn't written by man.
Okay, now that, well, I was going to get to that. That's a very interesting point. And we're going to discuss that. You know, is this a handwritten book? Is it man-written? Is it cable? Is it God? I want to ask something of you. In order for me to share with you my perspective, traditional Judaism's perspective, I want to ask you to do something for me. That's a major question. Is the book divine or is the book not divine? Agree with me that many of the major questions that all of us have will ultimately come down to that particular question. And therefore, how you read this book is very much determined by your relationship with that question. So I want to ask of you, while we're studying together, to read this book as though it's divine. Now, I'm not saying that you should think it's divine. As a matter of fact, I think it's good to challenge whether or not it's divine. I think that that's a very lengthy topic and one that's very, very much worth looking into. And I hope during these 3 weeks, I know in at least one class I'm going to have a chance to discuss it with you. And I hope during we're actually having our first question and answer session today. Please, please, please remind me, if either at the end of class or right before I take the break, to tell you about that. But this is the type of question, if you're curious about it, I'd be glad to discuss. But I want you to read it as though it's divine. In other words, it seems to me that if I'm reading a book, and the question is it written by man or written by God? If I read the book as though it were written by God, it will very often allow me to see all sorts of insights that I wouldn't have noticed. Right? What would I expect of a book written by God, just out of curiosity? I mean, if this book was written by God, we're by the way making some major assumptions here. We're making an assumption that there is a God. And even though I personally, you know, have such a relationship and it makes sense to me, it doesn't mean that I assume that it should make sense to any of you, right? But we're assuming for the moment that there's a God, we're assuming for the moment that God then created the world, and that God remained involved in the world. He didn't just disappear, which also makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, the Jewish definition, traditionally, of God is that God is unlimited, whatever that means. If God is unlimited, then God can't be physical, right? Because if you're physical, you're limited. The definition of something physical is that it's here and it's not there. So that's why part of the Jewish definition of God is that God isn't physical. All of the other factors that go into the Jewish definition of God relate to God being unlimited. Right? So for example, pan-creationism, which suggests that God created the world, but then he left it. He went on to other things. Right? Okay, maybe God created the world, but now I don't believe he's involved in the world, which is a legitimate point of view, you know. The only problem with that point of view for me personally, and again, you know, what you do with it is up to you, is that in order for God to be involved in the world, God just has to know what's going on. God knows what's going on. So what God does about that, I don't know. But that God knows what's going on, so that means that God's involved in the world. In order, therefore, for God not to be involved in the world, God has to not know what's going on. In order for God not know what's going on, that means God is limited. So everything gets back to that same definition when you stop to think about it, right? So we're making a lot of assumptions here. That there's a God, that God's involved in the world, God created it. If God did create the world, and if God is involved in the world, it stands to reason that God created me, human beings. It stands to reason that at a certain point, God's going to want to communicate to me why he put me here. I mean, what am I doing here? There'd be no value to my being here if at some point God doesn't come along and say, listen, now here is exactly what I want you to do. So we call that a revelation. That's why every religion has a revelation. Because the minute you have religion, you have a relationship with God, you've got to try to understand what God wants of you. So Judaism believes that this is that revelation. This is supposed to tell me what it is that I'm doing here. So therefore, what I want you to do is I want you to be able to try to take a look at and read this book as though it's divine. As though it's written by God, if there's a God. So now I'm back to my original question. So what would I expect of a book that's written by God? Just out of curiosity. Pardon?
That it's all true.
Okay.
You have to accept that it's all true.
That it's all true, right? God's not going to write in there and say, water's dry, you know, it'd just be dumb, yeah?
That it's a communication.
That it's all a communication. Very true. There are no unnecessary details.
That it's going to bring me closer to understanding God.
That it's going to bring me closer to understanding God and understanding what it is I'm supposed to be doing here. In all of its details. Very interesting. That it's, pardon?
Before, you know, that it's basically infused with consistent morality.
Okay. That there's some ethical moral system that flows throughout it. I can't assume, if it is divine, that part of it is ethical and part of it isn't ethical. That wouldn't make sense. I have to define my ethics almost by what I find in this book, which can be sometimes difficult. I'll give you another example. If you ever listen to an American speaker. I remember once I heard the speaker for President Clinton, you know, they have this like the what's it called? The White House press aide, I forget what the proper title is. And he's discussing something with the press corps. And you always know that he's not quite being as open with them as they would like when he throws in a lot of ums, you know. The proper method in choosing this particular candidate, you know, the president feels that he's searching for words. In Israel, they translated the word into eh. Have you ever heard this, right? That's the Hebrew translation for eh. Especially found when an Israeli is speaking English. I want to say to you that you won't find eh in the Bible if it's divine. Because God doesn't eh. God doesn't have to think about what he's going to say next. You won't find unnecessary words. I had a teacher once, Rabbi Lichtenstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of Gush, who had a gift at being able to find a myriad of adjectives for a given word. And he would list these adjectives in the course of his discussion. This blanket was beautiful, magnificent, stupendous, tremendous. And, you know, you get the point already. And it was valuable as a lesson to me, just to see how wonderful an expanded vocabulary could be. But God doesn't seem to do that. So if I'm reading this book as divine, then every word must have meaning. Every letter must have meaning, because why would God say something if there was no purpose to it? So it challenges me in different ways. So I don't want you to accept that there is a God, or that God wrote this Bible, because that's something that requires thought. But read it as though it's divine. See if it makes a difference into how you read it. Now it gets interesting. If this is a book of mitzvot, if it's a book of laws, if it's a book of guidelines, if it's a book of life, then how would I expect this book to begin? And what would I expect to find in it? Well, so one day someone tells me, you know, Judaism, there's this tremendous idea in Judaism. And that idea is, pick one. Tremendous custom, tremendous tradition, ritual practice. And that is, pick one. Shabbat. Okay, good. Shabbat. Oh, tremendous Shabbat. Whatever. So you walk away and he's told you all about Shabbat and how he loves Shabbat, but you know what Shabbat is. So you figure, okay, people of the book, this is the book. Let's go take a look. So you naturally open up to page one and you start reading. And it starts talking to you about Genesis and animals and plants and trees and creation. It's all very interesting, but okay. And then you read some more and it starts talking to you about Adam and Eve. And then you read some more and start talking to you about Noah. And then you read some more, and this is, you know, taking you now days, and you get to Abraham. Now you remember somewhere that Abraham is the first Jew. So you're great, now we're going to get to Shabbat. And then you read about Abraham, and you read some more about Abraham, and you read some more about Abraham. And then you read about Lot's nephew, and you read about his wife Sarah, and you read about his son Isaac, and then you get to Ishmael, and then you get to Yaakov, and all these different stories. And I want you to know you spend a long time till you get to Shabbat. It's the middle of the second book. And I haven't dealt with the makeup of the book yet, but Exodus, way out there. So I don't get it. In fact, there are almost no mitzvot, no commandments in the whole book of Genesis. The whole first book of the Torah, it doesn't talk to me about commandments. It's just stories. It's a storybook. So I figure, okay, we all got it wrong. It's a storybook. It's not a history book. Or is it a history book? Maybe that's it. Maybe it's a history of stories. Great idea. Except I can't believe that that's the whole deal. So what's going on here? And sure enough, eventually you get to Sinai, and then you get to Exodus. And when you hit really like the 22nd, 23rd, 24th chapters of Exodus, then you start to get into 60, you know, into tons of different commandments and ideas and laws and details. And then you start missing the stories. So what's the deal? How does this work? So I want to give you a tremendous idea. And this really relates to a topic that we discussed yesterday. We were talking yesterday about ethics. I left you with two questions yesterday, if you remember. Question number one, what do I need Judaism for? Why is Judaism this separate thing? I would think that if we all want to be a world together and live in peace and harmony, that we'd be better off not having isms. We should all just be the brotherhood of man. Question number two, right, was how do I go about developing this ethical system? How do I communicate this ethical system? Maimonides has an incredible idea regarding mitzvot. A mitzvah will call for the moment. Literally, it's translated as commandment. I don't like that translation. You should know, unfortunately, the value in studying Hebrew, you will always lose something in translation. That's just the way it is. You will hear about certain Jewish books that it's even valuable to read them in English instead of in Hebrew because they were first translated into English and then from there, one of Maimonides' famous books, into Hebrew. So you're closer to the original words of Maimonides in English. So, the word commandment doesn't do it for me. I look at it more as an opportunity, as a celebration. Maimonides deals with an interesting question. What's better? Mine is not to reason why, mine is but to do or die. In other words, is there a value to activity based on faith alone? Or is there a value to doing that which makes sense? In other words, should I be plunging into the abyss of blind faith? And there can be a tremendous value to that. You know, we look back at the Holocaust and we have difficulty understanding why they went like sheep to the slaughter. You know, if you went to the Umstagplatz, the central place, square of the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942 in the summer, they were rounding up 6,000 Jews a day for the trains to Auschwitz. There were, at certain instances, less than 100 guards. That's 60 Jews to a guard. They didn't even have enough bullets to... How could they just get in the trains? And that's a problem that we have. And we're blessed to have that question. It means that we're growing up in a generation where we take it for granted that a Jew has the ability to hold his head up high, to walk proud, to fight back if God forbid need be. Something I think you'll get more of a sense of on Sunday and Monday when we go to Har Herzl. But there was a whole different dimension. There was a tremendous sense of faith that these Jews walked into the ovens saying the Shema. And we can't even begin to imagine what that must have been like. So there's a tremendous value to faith, even if it's difficult for me to understand it. I mentioned to you the other day, I don't do things only if I understand them. If I'm given an order under fire in the army, I don't have time to understand them. And yet the Rambam goes so far, Maimonides goes so far as to say, and I'm purposely not discussing to you who Maimonides is, because that's one of our classes in this course, medieval commentator, but Maimonides goes so far as to say that in order to develop a relationship with a mitzvah, you must try to understand it. Which relates to our first discussion of 2 days ago. If I want to have a relationship with this mitzvah, I've got to try to understand what it means to me. But the Rambam goes one step further. Because Maimonides says, I'll tell you how to do that. How do I make sense out of Kashrut? How do I make sense out of Shabbat? Says Maimonides, what's the purpose of Judaism? Why do I need Judaism? What's the purpose of Torah? The purpose of Judaism is to make the world ethical. To make this a better place to be. And if we're right, if this book is a divine book, says Maimonides, then everything is geared towards that system. Every mitzvah, every facet, every detail is somehow designed to make me an ethical person. And therefore the idea of Shabbat makes me a better human being. Says Maimonides, my challenge with mitzvot is to figure out how a mitzvah makes me more ethical. I'll give you one quick example. Take, for example, the question of kashrut, of kosher, right? So what does it matter if I mix milk and meat? It's very strange. What does milk represent? What does meat represent? Meat in the Bible represents cruelty. It's interesting that in the Bible, originally man was not supposed to eat meat. Adam was given the ability to be only a vegetarian. And eventually, after the flood, man started to eat meat. And that's another discussion, that's also in June, but meat represents the hunt. Esav, who's known in the Bible as a cruel figure, is an ish yodei tzayid, an ish sadeh, man of the hunt. And what is milk? Milk represents mercy. Mother's milk. The image in the Bible of mercy is the baby suckling at the mother's breast. That's what milk represents. Meat represents the taking of life. Milk represents the giving of life. The process of getting milk is so antithetical to the process of getting meat. Says the Bible, and this is at a certain stage in man's development, there's a value to both. There's a need for both. But don't ever confuse the two. Don't ever mix them up. Sometimes there is mercy which is really cruel, and sometimes there is cruelty which is really merciful, and it's very difficult sometimes to know the difference. Don't mix the two up. That's part of the challenge. I'll give you maybe one quick example. And by the way, if when I eat meat and choose not to eat milk with it, I go through this thought process, then somehow perhaps I become a better person. But I'll give you a good example. I remember, this is, I don't know, the summer of 82, 83, 84, I don't remember anymore. We were in Beirut. And we were on a tank patrol. Tanks are not designed for warfare in the city. A tank is an immense fighting vehicle. It's an awesome responsibility. 52 tons of armor, 3 heavy machine guns, a 105mm cannon, phosphorus grenades, smoke, your own personal machine guns and weapons, and a tank barreling down a field in a wide open space has an immense firepower. But when you're in a city and you're in between apartment buildings, and you have to all go in a line, so you can't bring the full firepower to bear. You have to go slower. The Israeli army is very concerned with civilian casualties. It gives you that extra second of thought before you can fire. It limits you. So it's not a comfortable feeling to be a tank commander inside a city. And we're doing a patrol down Beirut. And I was a platoon commander, which meant that there were 3 tanks under my command. And we come around a corner, and we're going up the street, and all of a sudden I see what has become already a familiar sight. It's the tube of an RPG. Now, when you're in officer's course, they drill into you what's called Toda. Toda is the ability to recognize enemy weaponry. You know, you have to spot a helicopter at a few kilometers, and you have to know, is it an Israeli one or is it a Syrian one? You can't wait until it gets close enough, because then it's too late. You see an enemy tank. Terrible stories. Especially, by the way, in the American Army in World War II, of whole tank battles that were fought because people mixed up friend and foe. So every Friday morning before we would get out for Shabbat, we would have a test. And if you didn't pass this test, you didn't get out for Shabbat. So we were fanatic about recognizing enemy armor and enemy helicopters and enemy. So you sort of knew how to see these things in your sleep. So out comes this tube of an RPG, which is a handheld Russian anti-tank grenade. And it comes out, and there's a little boy holding this tube. He couldn't have been more than 7 or 8. And he gets down on one knee, and I'm close enough, we're maybe 200 meters, 150 meters, I can see his face. Now, you don't have a chance to think about this. The gunner doesn't have a chance to focus, because the gunner's sight is designed so that he can see a tank at 5-6 kilometers. So it's a very narrow scope. And you have an override control, it's called a mashbet. And you can override his gunnery controls, so that you sort of turn the turret of the tank to where you want it. And generally in the field, that's what you do. You sort of bring him to the general area, and then he says, "Ah, I see it," right? And then you let go, and he does his gunnery work. That's the way it works. You also have an overriding trigger, so that in a case of a battle where you're at close quarters, where you don't have time to bring the gunner to it, and he says, "I see it," and then he aims and he fires, you just have to, it's like the Wild West, you have to bring the gun sort of with this mashbet, and you're standing way up high in the turret, and you're leaning down, and you've got it so there's a marking already on your turret, so you more or less know how to find it, and you've got to lean into it, and then fire. And you only have a second. And you know intellectually that if you don't get this RPG before he fires, he'll shred your tank like a can of onions. And there's three other men in your tank who are depending on you. And there's two other tanks, by the way, because usually these things were fired as part of an ambush. They'd hit the front tank, someone would hit the back tank. So you don't have that much time to think about it. But he's a 7-year-old boy. You can't blame him for what he's doing. He's been indoctrinated. It's one of the things that I could never forgive them for, is enlisting children to do this, but, you know, that's another discussion. I want to tell you, what a 105mm tank shell does to a human being is a horrible thing to see. And until the day I die, I will see the image of this child's body flying through the air. And don't think it doesn't affect you, and don't think that later, even though you know intellectually you're right, and you have no qualms in terms of your conscience, it affects you. And the Israeli army is an amazing institution, and they, every so often they would take soldiers in the front lines down, and we went to Netanya for a week by the beach, and we laughed at these social workers that they brought to talk to us, and this sort of thing, whatever, very healthy experience. All the guys got everything out, a very healthy experience. You know, I look at stories about Vietnam veterans, and I understand how valuable it is that the Israeli army takes this so seriously. But it doesn't mean that it's not there in some distant pocket that comes out. So was I cruel or was I kind? Was I displaying cruelty or mercy? Well, mercy would have been cruel. Because who would have gone to the parents of my men to explain to them how their sons were killed? So it's not always so easy. And one of the challenges in life is to try to find the line. And it's interesting that Jewish tradition says, how do you find that line? How do I know what's cruel and what's kind? If the only way I know what's cruel and what's kind is what I think is cruel and I think it's kind, then that becomes very difficult. And this relates to our discussion yesterday. If I make my own ethic, it doesn't work. Comes along the Torah and says, I'll give you a guideline for ethics. And that guideline for ethics includes all of the general principles of life. If someone's trying to kill you, you're allowed to kill them first. In fact, you even have an obligation to kill them first. And that's a very difficult mitzvah. And you can do almost anything to save a human life. You can violate Shabbat, you can eat pig meat, anything. Except for three particular commandments, that's another discussion. So let's say then that this book is about Jewish ethics. How do I go about doing it? How do I communicate those ethics? And what is that system of ethics? So it comes along the Torah and says to me a tremendous thing. And in order to express this to you, I have to share with you one more thought. There's a very strange story that comes when we get to the stories of Abraham. There's a famous story, Abraham, in the beginning of Parshat Vayera, the portion known as Vayera, is sitting in the entrance to his tent, Kechom Hayom. That's what it says, V'hu Yoshev Petach Ha'oel Kechom Hayom. He's sitting in the entrance of his tent, outside the tent, in the heat of the day. Now, maybe a little background information. First of all, this was the third day after he was commanded to be circumcised in the Bible. Second of all, he's a 99-year-old man, according to the Bible, right? So this is a 99-year-old guy who's just circumcised himself on the third day, which is supposed to be the most painful day. You should know there are all sorts of halachot, of laws regarding visiting the sick. You're not supposed to visit someone on the third day after their operation unless they're very, very close to you, because that's the most difficult day. And I can tell you it's definitely true. So, he's sitting outside. And the Midrash, we're going to talk about what Midrash is, but we'll call it for the moment, rabbinic legend goes so far as to say, this wasn't just a hot day. You know, the Torah, I mean, taking into account my original supposition, the Torah doesn't, you know, this is the only place that I know of in the whole Torah that it tells me what the weather is. You know, the Torah isn't interested in the weather. You know? Joshua went around Jericho and it was cloudy skies and partly sunny. It's not, you know, it's just not there. So if the Torah takes the time to tell me it's a hot day, it was a hot day. I mean, we're not talking about 90 in the shade. We're talking the greatest heat wave in human history. You know, the Medrash likes to get carried away sometimes. So he's sitting out in the desert on a scorcher of a day. Why? Medrash says because he had no guests. He was out looking for guests. He was hoping he would see a traveler and he could invite him into his tent. Medrash says that Abraham had four openings on his tent so that from any direction a person would see the door open and come in. Tremendous idea. Don't try building your house this way. Your spouse might not appreciate it. But, you know, tremendous idea. And then it says, Vayar, and he sees, Vihinei shlosha anashim nitzavim alav, and three men are bearing down on him. They're walking towards him. They see him. Now the Bible goes on to say these are angels. I'm not going to talk to you about what angels are. But as far as he knows, so it seems in the Bible, he thinks they're guys out for a walk, and they're walking towards him. Vayar, and he sees them again. Vayar atzlikvatam, and he runs to them. 99-year-old guy, biggest heat wave in history, 3 days after his circumcision, they're walking towards him anyway, and he gets up and he starts running to them. He's so excited about having guests. So you look at this guy and you think, cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Right? There's something wrong with him. So first of all, Abraham in the Bible represents human kindness. And all the stories that you read about Abraham, you see. And by the way, Sarah even more so, but that's another story. Human kindness. And he is a living ethic. And you get the sense almost that he couldn't bear not having the opportunity to do good for other people. I've met people like this in my life. People who are so good that it pains them. Somebody once came to my door, I live in a frat, somebody once came to my door on Friday night and said, do you have guests? I said, yeah. He said, can I have a couple? I said, excuse me? He said, yeah, you know, we had guests, they didn't show up, I don't know what happened, we have food, we have no guests. Like most people say, like, the guests didn't show up, we got a quiet family time. I said, you want some guests because you have no guests? He said, yeah, we can't have Friday night dinner without guests, what are we going to do? I said, you can't have mine. And tremendous. This is Abraham. But I want to point out to you something fascinating about Abraham. The Bible says, Vayar, he sees that there are three people coming towards him. And then it says again, Vayar, he sees again, Vayar at Likratam. He runs to them. Why does it say Vayar twice? Why does it say twice in the Bible and he sees? He saw them. It doesn't have to say twice he saw them. And again, if this is a Bible, it's written somehow divinely, so then every word makes a difference. So why does it say that? So the first time he sees them, he sees that they're incredible individuals. He sensed that the divine presence, says the Medrash, say the rabbis, rested upon these men. Tremendous Torah scholars. And then it says, Vayar, what did he see the second time he looked? Shenahagu kavod zelazeh. They treated each other with respect. I don't know, maybe one of them said, no, you go first. Then he gets up and he starts running to them. Now that's a fascinating comment. First time he sees that they're tremendous Torah scholars. He sees that the divine presence rests on these men. Now, I want to tell you, I like to think that we're all trying to make ourselves, you know, on a higher level every day. And I think that, you know, the Talmud says that when you study Torah together, the divine presence comes to rest amongst you, right here with us, whatever that means. But this is a comment that I don't think the average person would say about me. He still doesn't run to them. Alright, they're tremendous Torah scholars. When he sees how they treat each other, then he gets up and runs to them. That's what his focus was. Now what does he do when he gets to them? And now I'm ready to make the point. Three things. He says, I'm going to fetch you some bread. Ekcha na lachem pat lachem. I will take for you, if that's the right quote, I will take for you some bread. Right? And then he says, Yukachna ma'atmayim, let there be taken some water. So there are three activities here. He runs to them to bring him into his house, out in the hot sun. He gets them bread himself. And then he says, someone should bring them water. So the rabbinic tradition, the Medrash, rabbinic legend, says a fascinating thing. It says, because Abraham ran in the hot sun in the desert to get to them, the Jewish people, Abraham's descendants, 400 years later, merited to have clouds of glory that protected them from the sun in the desert. Now, that, by the way, is an incredible comment on its own. It relates to something else that we said the other day. That one action can have this tremendous effect that millions of Jews walking through the desert have the clouds of glory because one guy decided to run in a heat wave. And then it says, because he took for them bread himself, and he was a wealthy man, Abraham, according to the Bible, but he himself takes the bread, so therefore the Jewish people in the desert merited, anybody can guess? The manna, right? The heavenly bread that fell from heaven, whatever that means. Now listen to this. Says the Medrash, says rabbinic legend, because he didn't run to get the water himself, but rather he said, let there be taken for them water. Someone should get them water. You know, it's like sometimes you find this, you know, you're sitting in a board meeting or you're sitting in a dining room, you know. Boy, someone should really clean up this dining room. You know? Someone should clean it up. You're right. Get up and clean it up. So Abram says, no, someone should get them water. So because of that, the Jewish people had all sorts of problems with water in the desert. And if you read the Bible, especially the book of Numbers, you see all the problems the Jewish people had in the desert was with water. They didn't have water. The water was bitter. They couldn't find the water. Moshe wanted the water. He spoke to the rock. He hit the rock. All these problems with water. They almost got killed by the water with the splitting of the sea. They had to cross the water in the Jordan. All the problems with water. Okay, so that's a nice little idea. Except there's one problem with it. Do you know what the problem is? It doesn't make any sense. Because if you read the Medrash explains, and it's clear from the verse, who was Abraham talking to? Who was Abraham telling to get water for the guests? He was telling his son, Ishmael. He was saying to Ishmael, you should get some water for the guests. So what's wrong with that? That's tremendous. He's teaching his son. He's telling his son, I want you to do acts of kindness. I want you to become a better person. I want you to get some water for the guests. That's educational, it's viable, it's doable, it's magnificent. So how come he's punished? How come the Jewish people suffer for this? So I once heard from Rabbi Riskin a magnificent thought in the name of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was one of the tremendous Torah scholars of the last generation. He says, if you want to teach your son ethics, you can't tell him what to do. You have to do it. Because he's going to learn a lot more from what you do than from what you say. I was talking to somebody about this yesterday. We teach, and people learn from what we do. I want to tell you something fascinating. If you look through the story of Abraham, first Jew, three portions in the Torah, that's huge. He never once tells anyone how to be an ethical person. That's incredible. He doesn't leave a will. He doesn't say to Isaac, listen, Isaac, here's how you're going to be an ethical person. I want you to emulate me. I want you to give charity. Never. He doesn't ever tell anyone how to do it. I would expect him to give all sorts of ethical messages and ethical teachings. Nothing. Because we don't learn ethics from Abraham by virtue of his telling us how to be ethical. We learn ethics from Abraham by virtue of his being ethical. That's why the whole first book of the Torah is stories. Ethical role models. As if the Torah is telling me, I want you to learn from these individuals. These were individuals of sterling character. These were people whose actions can be a model for how we can behave. For what we as human beings can aspire to. I once saw a movie. I don't remember the name of the movie. It was a bit of a dumb movie. There was a guy who was practicing to be a weightlifter, and he was trying to get himself down to be in the next weight class so that he could wrestle the greatest wrestler in their neighborhood or whatever it was, I don't know, the college. And he was having a discussion with some good friend of his who was a cook. And this cook was describing to him, motivating him not to give up and to keep going, saying that he was watching the Olympics once. And there was a famous Ethiopian runner who, I think in the 72 Olympics, who ran the marathon barefoot. I forget his name. Do you know his name? Anybody know his name? No? Okay, but it was an amazing story. And he won the marathon. And he didn't have the big Olympic trainers, and he didn't have the big bucks, but he just, force of will, he ran the marathon. And when he finished the marathon and came in with his bare feet from Ethiopia, right, all the people standing there started to clap. People stood on their feet because, you know, they run into the stadium. The whole stadium got up on its feet. And if you know anything about the Olympics, there's like all these different events that are going on at the same time. Like he's running in here, and there's a javelin throw going over there. Everybody stopped what they're doing. Somebody was just about to, I think, pole vault and stopped. And people just started clapping. And this guy in the movie, he says, you know, when I saw that, he says, I started to cry. He says, you know why I started to cry? Not because he won. Because when I watched this individual, I became proud that I was a human being. I was proud to be of the same human race that this person was a part of. This person, when he came into that stadium, made the world a better place. That's tremendous. Sometimes you meet people and you see things and you become a better person just by watching it. You spend time with them. You know, I have a close friend, Rav Twersky. He's almost 65 years old. He lives on my block. He only comes a couple months a year. He was just here for Pesach. I speak with this person. I want you to know, whenever I speak with him, I walk away, I feel fulfilled. And we don't have to be talking about Torah. He's one of the most ethical people I've ever met. And it's just, you stand around this guy, and you're just proud to be someone who can relate to him. It's a magnificent feeling. That was Abraham. That's what the Torah is trying to communicate to me. And I want to go you one further. If the goal of Judaism is to make the world a better place, to make the world a more ethical place, and if it's all a part of that system, if Shabbat makes me a more ethical person, if Shabbat teaches me, you know, the verse says in the Bible, "Leman yanuach avdecha v'amatcha v'shorcha v'chamorcha kamocha." Part of the purpose of Shabbat is that your ox and your donkey, your slaves, everything should rest like you. What difference if my donkey rests, but my donkey needs a day off? Thanks, boss. When I let my donkey rest, when I choose not to use my donkey on Shabbat, it's an incredible social statement about the value of living creatures and the world and mankind. Tremendous idea. If the whole system of Torah is ethical, and I want to make the world an ethical place, says the Torah, don't think you're going to teach the world ethics by preaching ethics. You're going to teach the world ethics by doing ethics. You know, it's all the drivers who drive around and tell everybody else how to drive. If everybody would just worry about driving themselves well, there wouldn't be car accidents. That's the challenge. And I want to tell you something. If you look, and we have to take a break, if you look at the beginning of the Bible, the world is created, we're all one humanity. Everybody all together. Adam and Eve. Kabbalah says, why was there a first man? Why did God make a first man and a first woman? Especially given what I mentioned to you yesterday, that there were generations of human beings possibly beforehand, whatever that means. Why not start with 10? I mean, it's a lot of work to be one human being. You know, they had two sons, one of them got killed, then they had another one. So you got four people, you know how much work it is to run the world with four people? All that work to do, why not just start with 50? And the Kabbalah says, because by virtue of the fact that there was a first man and a first woman, what the Torah is telling me is that we're all from the same person. We're all distant cousins. We all belong with each other. That's a tremendous idea. And the whole world is supposed to be a brotherhood of man. Because we're all Adam's children. How could you not get along? And we're all his grandchildren. We're all his great-grandchildren. Eve is all of ours, mother. And then it doesn't work. It takes 10 generations. It doesn't work. Man has sunken to such a level of corruption, violence, theft, that the world can't be. Because if there are no ethics in the world, then what's the purpose to the world? If the whole purpose is to make the world better, to come closer to God, to emulate God, to give good, if all we're doing is evil, what's the purpose? So the world is destroyed in the flood. And again, if you're reading the book, it's a divine book. Well, God created it. God can destroy it. Very difficult to understand. We're going to get to that towards the end of this course. Is God ethical? But okay. But he does the same thing again, God. He, she, it. Noah and Noah's wife are again, Adam too, they're the parents of all of mankind. Tries again, and again it doesn't work. And again they sink into the morass of idolatry. And the world is not destroyed only because God has promised not to destroy the world again. Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed. What makes a difference? One individual, instead of being created by God and told, don't eat, finds God all on his own. Abraham and Sarah find God and they begin a process. And it's very interesting. In the first portion where God speaks to Abraham, there are two very tremendous ideas. God says to Abraham, V'nivrechu v'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama, and through you will be blessed all the families on the earth. In the beginning of the portion of Lech Lecha, you can look it up. It's in, because that's a valuable section to read. So if you're looking to find something, it's on page 12 in chapter 12. Through you will be blessed all the families of the earth. It's interesting that the Bible portrays the earth as families. That's how it's supposed to be. You know, I remember I used to teach in a camp in the summers. It was a big camp, Camp Moshava, a huge camp. And on Shabbat especially, everybody would eat together, and you'd have a dining room full of like 700-800 people. And because it was a traditional camp, they didn't use a microphone on Shabbat. So when you had to get everybody quiet, you can imagine it was a difficult task. And there was always one poor slab who would have to get up on a bench and start yelling and screaming, shh, everybody quiet, shh, come on. And they'd be up there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And one Shabbat, I couldn't handle it anymore. Just was like, you know, let's do the worst educational thing we can do. Just 15 minutes trying to get everybody quiet. So I got up on a bench, said, do you mind if I try, right? And I looked across the room and I saw one of my students, you know, one of the younger kids sitting across the room. I said, Ezra, be quiet! Everybody turned around, you know, right? And the whole place went quiet. Because if you walk into a room and you say, everybody be quiet, well, he's not talking to me, he's talking to everybody. You understand? If I say, Rebecca, be quiet! Well, then maybe he'll talk to me. Sometimes it doesn't work, everybody go all together. If you want to get something done, you can't say, listen, we have to set up the bonfire for Lag B'Omer. Because it just won't get done. Right? So listen, Emily, would you mind setting up the bonfire? That's exactly the relationship that develops between God and Abraham. But it's very interesting. Because the reason it works is because Abraham doesn't say, great idea. And he goes out and starts to say, listen, I discovered God, and I'm going to tell you how to do it. No. Abraham just becomes ethical. And people want to emulate Abraham, and it takes a few generations because he's so ethical. That's my challenge. If I want to make the world a better place, I'm a world. I should make myself a better place. If I can make myself into such an ethical world that other people walk by me and want to emulate me just because of who I am, then that's of tremendous value. And it's interesting, by the way, that the first thing that God says to Abraham, God finally meets Abraham, first discussion. What would you expect God to say the first time he has a discussion with Abraham? Hey, big guy, you know, thanks for praying to me these last couple of years. I just wanted to come on down and introduce myself. No, God says, Lech Lecha. Anybody ever hear that verse? Go to the land of Canaan. Go to Israel. In other words, the first thing that God says to Abraham is, go! Get out of here! It's very strange. And he says, Lech Lecha. Get thee out. That's how they translate it, I think, in the Bible, right? Get thee out of my country. You know, that country. Get thee out! Great, I love it. But in Hebrew, it translates Lech Lecha. To you. For you. You have to find out who you are. You have to go. We're each of us on a journey. It's not an easy journey. And we're looking to find something. We're looking to find out who we are. We're looking to find out what if, where God is. We're looking to find the people that will become meaningful in our lives. We're on that journey. And we have to realize we're on that journey. And the ultimate question with regard to that journey is, am I moving forward or am I moving backwards? Suggests Maimonides, this journey is a journey of ethics. It's an ethical journey. And if every day I will attempt to be a little bit more ethical than I was the day before, then I'll get there one day. That's exactly the message of the Bible, and that's why the Bible begins the way it begins. And that's why the whole beginning of the Bible is all about stories and all about role models. And by the way, one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself is to find such a role model. The Mishnah says, "Asei lecha rav," make for yourself a teacher. It doesn't say pick one. It doesn't say study with one. Make one. Develop a relationship with someone who you think is ethical. When I was growing up, I had a teacher, Rav Riskin. And I found him to be an incredible teacher. And I put in a tremendous amount of energy to develop a relationship with him. And it was tremendously valuable. You can't have a role model who lives in a book. Maimonides can't be my role model. He doesn't know me. I don't know him. I don't know his shortcomings. That's part of the challenge. So that's the beginning of what this book is. So what is this book and how does it work? I've sensed frustration sometimes in terms of the makeup and how to use this book. So first of all, there are five books. The traditional understanding, you know, which is the one that I'm coming to, we discussed that already, is that these five books are divine. Now, I'm going to talk to you in the next class about the difference between these five books and the prophets, so don't worry about that for now. But these five books are divine. How exactly they were written down? Did Moses write them? Did God write them? Did God transmit it to be given to Moses to be written? That also we're going to get to when we talk about the Agadah and the Halakha in this course, so don't worry about that. There are five books. The first book is the book of Genesis, right? And I want you to follow with me. It begins on page 2, very easy to find. By the way, if you want to get a great Bible, and you're not looking for commentary, you just want English translation, which is debatable, this Bible, that's the reason we have it, this Koren Tanakh, has all the Bible, the prophets, the writings, everything, and it's a pretty good translation as translation goes. I don't know of anyone that has a better translation on the whole thing together. So this is a good volume. It's a little bit expensive, but this is a good volume to have. But anyway, you know, if you decide at some point, right? The book of Genesis takes us from the creation of the world all the way up to, anybody know? To the...
Going into Egypt.
I'm talking about book of Genesis now. I'm sorry. The book of Genesis takes us just from the creation of the world until the end of the story of Joseph and his brothers. Because that's the point at which the Jewish families, really, they're not yet a people, go down to Egypt. So that's the first book. Bereshit, it's called. It's called Bereshit, by the way, because it begins with Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et haaretz. God first created the heavens and the earth. I want to point out to you something, by the way, very interesting. People think that this book is a history book. It's very interesting. Noah, the first portion, each book is divided into subsections called portions. These divisions are very, very old. We know of them existing, at least in the time of the Second Temple. Tradition, Jewish tradition has it that these divisions also are part of the oral tradition that was passed down. But in any event, the first portion is known as Bereshit. And that deals with the creation of the world up until the time of Noah. Which is a period of almost 1100, 1200 years. In one portion. The second portion deals with Noah from the period of time that he's building the ark until the end of the Tower of Babel and the birth of Abraham. And that's a period of about 500 years. So already you have one portion, the first portion, which is 10 generations, which is 1200 years. Second portion is 500 years. Third portion, and the fourth portion, and the fifth portion, deal with the life of Abraham, but only from the time he was 99 years old. So you're talking about some 80 years. And then you have a few portions of Isaac, right, which are also about 100 years. And then you have even more portions, four or five portions, which deal with the story of Jacob over the period of over 100 years. So, and when you get to books later on, like for example, the book of Exodus, well, the book of Exodus deals with just 1 year, the year they got out of Egypt. When you look at the book of Deuteronomy, which is the fifth book, and I'll get to this, don't worry, that deals, according to some commentaries, with one day. So obviously, this is not a history book. Because a history book doesn't work that way. It wouldn't take 1,200 years and devote a portion to it, and take one day and devote a whole book to it. So you can imagine that the issues here are much different, and it takes time to get into them, and you have a sense of them from what I've been talking about. So let me give you a basic structure. So the first book is the creation of the world, up until the time the Jewish people go down to Egypt. And that deals with the history of man. It deals with the first Jew. It deals with how the idea of Judaism and monotheism came about. The second book, the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, begins from the Jewish people entering the land of Egypt as a family, 70 individuals, how they leave Egypt as a people. The process of that development. Their journey into the desert. The splitting of the sea. The giving of the Torah. The sin of the golden calf. And the building of the tabernacle. Okay, if I'm speaking too fast, so slow me down. All right? But these are things, by the way, that you can pick up as you go along by reading, so don't worry if you... So what is the theme of the second book? The second book really is, how did a whole bunch of separate individuals become a nation? How did we develop our Jewish identity? And by the way, and this is a very powerful idea, but one of the courses that I teach here at Israelite, I don't remember offhand if it's next month, I think it's the month after next month, in July, is exactly that. So I'm a Jew. What does it mean to be a Jew? How do I become a Jew? Am I a Jew just because I'm born a Jew? Do I have to do something to be a Jew? How can I make myself more Jewish, whatever that means? What does my Jewish identity mean to me? And it could be that one of the best things to do would be to ask the first group of people who became Jews, what did it mean to you to become a Jew? How did you become a Jew? How did you change from being a family into being a people? Now, we can't ask them, but we can see their story. That's exactly what the book of Exodus is. And so that course is really a study of the book of Exodus, the beginning of it anyway. And it's an analysis of the transformation of individuals into a people, of human beings into Jews. Not, God forbid, to imply that there's Jews and then there's human beings, but you understand what I'm saying? And that's the book of Exodus. Now, once we've become a Jewish people, well, what do we do with that? And that's the book of Leviticus. The book of Leviticus is all about sacrifices. They're tremendous mitzvot, tremendous commandments. This week's portion, for example, Kedoshim, to be holy, that I quoted to you the other day, the 19th, etc. chapter in Leviticus, has, if I'm not mistaken, 56 commandments in 61 or 64 verses. It's unbelievable. 56 commandments in 60-some-odd verses. As if to say, you know, the first verse of this portion is that you shall be a holy people. You should become close to me, to God. That's what holiness really means, notwithstanding our discussion of the other day. As if the Torah is trying to tell me, okay, so how do you do this? Mitzvot. Ethical practice. Here's a list. And then I get to the book of Numbers. Very difficult book. The book of Numbers, really more than any other book, deals with the journey of the Jewish people through 40 years of desert. Which is a very valuable process. Because it takes them from being a people who got the Torah to being a people who communicated to the next generation. How do you communicate that? What is that journey? If we're each on an individual journey, we can also learn a lot from the journey of the Jewish people. And then you get to the fifth book. And the fourth book is called Numbers, but in Hebrew it's Bamidbar, in the desert. Which is, by the way, a very powerful idea. That the Jewish people have to spend time in the desert between getting the Torah and living the Torah. The desert, obviously, is not the goal. It's not the end. But it's a means. And sometimes it's true for us also. You know, sometimes we, as individuals, in order to develop our relationship with God, in order to find out who we are. So first of all, we have to leave Egypt. We have to get out of whatever it is that's holding us back. It's keeping us hostage to a certain extent. And sometimes in our lives, we go through periods where we have to have a little desert. We have to get away. We have to isolate ourselves. We have to have time to think. We have to process it. And it's very valuable to find the opportunities to do that in your regular existence. And then you get to the fifth book, which is the book of Deuteronomy, of Dvarim. Dvarim literally means words, things. Eileh ha-dvarim, these are the things, these are the words, asher diber Moshe, that Moses spoke to the Jewish people saying. Now what's fascinating about this book is that this book is the soliloquy. It's the final speech of Moses. And he's speaking to the Jewish people just as they are about to enter the land of Israel. So who's he talking to? He's talking to the second generation. And he's saying to the second generation, you're now going into the land of Israel. Are you going to be successful in living up to the ideals, the role models that were your parents? Will it last? The beginning of the book is almost a repeat of the entire history of the Jewish people up to that point, all the stories of the desert. And you find mention of all of them, Sinai and the Golden Calf, the Ten Commandments are repeated. One of the most fascinating issues in Deuteronomy is to study the differences between the two. What is Moses telling the second generation? What do I learn from both? How does this work out? This is a generation that grew up as free men and women. They grew up into a society and they took it for granted that they were free. Their parents didn't know anything of the sort. Their parents came from 210 years of slavery. Talk about a slave mentality. And then the Torah ends. And I got to tell you, we'll talk about this in our next class, but that's a very difficult question. Why does the Bible end there? The whole purpose of the Bible seems to be to get to the land of Israel. They're finally standing on the banks of the Jordan River. They're about to enter the land of Israel. And then the Torah stops. What does the Torah stop for? I would think the book of Joshua, certainly the beginning of it, through the 8th chapter or so, when they get into the land of Israel, should be in the Bible. It's a very difficult question. So without getting into the answer, it would seem at the very least that the book that we call the Torah, the Bible, the five books, are the books of Moses. The Torah ends because Moshe dies. Now why Moshe dies and doesn't get into the land of Israel, that's a bigger discussion. We won't get to that. But this is the book of Moshe. It's a book that's communicated to me through an individual by God. So this is, first of all, how the book works and what the different books are. Now, I will tell you one detail about the difference between the books of Moses and the books of the prophets, even though we have to get into the prophets more when we discuss the prophets. Moshe is known as the Eved Ne'eman, the faithful servant. Maimonides goes so far as to say, Maimonides has a section in his commentary to the Mishnah. Don't worry if you don't know what the Mishnah is. It's part of the oral tradition, because we're going to discuss the Mishnah in one of the classes. But in his commentary, Maimonides lists what have become famous as the 13 principles of faith in Judaism. And basically what Maimonides is saying is these are 13 principles by which we as Jews live. One of those principles is that I believe with perfect faith that Moshe was a prophet of God and received the Torah from God. Now, why is Moshe so important? So there are two issues here. One is that since Moshe was the vehicle for the transmission of Torah, if I'm to accept the Torah as divine, then I have to preclude the possibility of it being subjective by virtue of its being transmitted by Moshe. Right? I mentioned this to somebody the other day. If I want to give Lisa a message, right? And I ask Eliza to give Lisa a message. So Lisa is not going to get the same message from Eliza that she's going to get from me. Because no matter how accurately and faithfully Eliza can transmit that message, she's not me. So the differences and how noticeable they are will probably more and more apparent the bigger the message is, right? I mean, if I tell Eliza, is it Liza or Eliza?
Eliza.
Eliza? Okay, sorry. If I tell Eliza to tell Lisa to make sure to put out all the, you know, chumashim, the Bibles, on the tables, you know, in front of everybody so that everybody can have a chumash, and Eliza comes along and says, you know, listen, make sure you put out all the Bibles on the table in front of everybody, right? So she leaves out the word chumash, which is the Hebrew word for the five books. Chamesh is five, Chumash are the five-foldeth book, whatever. So there's no major difference, right? But if I tell somebody, if I give someone a message, stop at the stop sign, because if you don't, you might get killed. And this person gives over the message, says stop at the stop sign. Well, you can imagine the difference between those two messages can be catastrophic. So Moshe is giving a pretty big message. Five books. He's a human being. Human beings make mistakes. Moshe made mistakes. One of the most tremendous things in the Bible, one of the things I value about Judaism, is that we don't hide the mistakes of our leadership. Moshe was a human being. He messed up. That's why he didn't get into the land of Israel. And we learn from his mistakes. King David made mistakes. Now, maybe they're not my mistakes. I don't put myself on the same level as Moses, but still. So if Moshe made mistakes, maybe one day, you know, maybe there was an 11th commandment. He forgot. I know it happens. You know? So part of the belief in Moshe is the belief that he was different than any other human being that ever lived. That he was capable of transmitting a message in its entirety, in its original form. Now there are big debates as to how this was accomplished. Was it some kind of miracle? Was it a testament to Moshe? Maimonides says that if you will attempt to become all that you can be, God will meet you halfway. That's a tremendous idea. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've discovered that this is so. And I'll give you maybe one quick example. When you study Torah, when you begin to study, you think that it's just not doable. How can you ever cover all this material? There's so much to know. And sometimes, I'll be talking with a student, and we'll be quoting different things, and they'll just say, how did you learn all that? Like, where did you get, how did you have the time? And I start to think about it, and they're right. It's a magnificent verse. I won't get into it. The verse basically says that when you begin to study Torah, your growth in Torah study doesn't grow geometrically. It's not like 1 plus 1 is 2 and 2 plus 2 is 4. At a certain point, you just take leaps. And I'll be honest with you, I've experienced it, I can't explain it. And the commentators discuss it, and the mystics discuss it, whatever it means. It's almost as though if you're willing to put in a certain amount of effort, it doesn't work in quotient. I had a student who went to yeshiva, and, they were telling him some of the things he'd be learning, and he's saying, how could a Jew not go through the 5 books of Moses? But it's going to take me my whole life to go through the 5 books of Moses. How am I going to have a chance to study Maimonides, study the Talmud, study oral law, written law? How am I going to do that? And Judaism certainly has a obsession, you can never do it all. There'll always be more. So I said to him, listen, don't ask yourself that question now. Because it's too mind-boggling. You can't spend your life thinking, how am I going to make it through 4 years of med school and residency and internship? Just make it through the day. Make it through the week. Can I make it through the semester? It's good to break life down. I said, but do me a favor. I want you to remember you asked me this question. And I want you to call me back at the end of the year. So sure enough, we were in touch. We're still in touch. Call me back a year later, year and a half later, whatever. And I said, it's a funny thing. You're calling me because I'm now at a place called Israelite, and we're having this program. Why don't you come visit? So he came, and then he came for his Rashi sheet. And he got here a little early. And there was another student who came a little earlier. And they started talking, and he said, well, you're learning, whatever. I was also a beginner, whatever. He wasn't an Israelite, but whatever. Why don't we study something? So they started to study. And they studied for half an hour, whatever it was, Chumash, whatever it was. And then they, went to Sudash Yashit, to the third meal, whatever. I was having a discussion with this Israelite student that week. And she was saying to me, I can't imagine. How am I ever going to be able to study all this stuff? Like, I'd like to pursue my Jewish studies. How am I ever? So, I was sitting with this guy. I just knew so much, he was quoting from Genesis, so much stuff. I gotta call this guy up and tell him. And I had this conversation with this guy on the phone. He said, you mentioned that, you're right. I can't imagine how I learned all this stuff this year. That there's a partnership. So that's one opinion. That's my Maimonides' opinion as to how Moshe was able to do what Moshe did. It was a gift, but it came as a result of a partnership. But that makes it different. And it's interesting that the prophets don't work that way. So we'll get to talking about the prophets when we get to the prophets. It's different. But that's a fundamental idea. And if you read the book that way, then it changes your perspective in the book. And again, I'm not telling you how anybody here should feel about it. But in terms of experiencing it, the only way to experience it, right, is to attempt to view it from that perspective. It's like art. Right? If you look at a Rembrandt, I once heard, maybe I'm getting it wrong, I'm not an art maven, but I love art. And I once heard from, I think it was Rabbi Beryl Wein, he said he was once walking through the Louvre Museum, right, in Paris. And he stopped to listen to a person leading a tour and in the museum. And the person was discussing Rembrandt. And he was pointing to the painting, and he said, look at the painting. And people were talking about the painting. He said, now I want you to do something different. Don't look at the painting. Don't look at the middle of the painting. Look at the light. Try to find where the light is coming from. And see if it changes the way you look at the painting. So he said, he was standing there, and he wasn't even a member of the tour, he was just watching it. He said, wow. He said, I can't look at a Rembrandt the same way anymore. It changes the whole way you look at it. I hope I'm getting it right. I hope it's Rembrandt. There's some art major, history major here, But, tremendous idea. So that's the 5 books of Moses. Now I want to go you one further. So what do I do? How do I study this? So there are different commentaries on the 5 books of Moses. I want to mention 2 or 3 of them just briefly, and then I'd like to take a look at a text with you to give you a sense of textual study. There are many commentaries, and they are endless. And there's a tremendous value to studying commentary. And you have to realize, by the way, as soon as you're reading a translation, you're studying commentary. And by the way, one of the most valuable things you can do is to try to limit your commentaries the first time you read something. This is true in all study. Right? Because when I first read a story, first I read the story, and I think about what I think about that story. And then I'll go back and I'll read a commentary and think about what does he think. And very often, you know, a commentary will say something and I'll understand why they're saying it, because they're really answering a question that I had on my own. And if I hadn't taken the time to consider that I had that question, I wouldn't realize why the commentary was saying that. So that's a very valuable process. So I'll mention two or three of the most famous commentaries just briefly. The most famous probably is Rashi. Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, son of Yitzchak Shlomo, medieval commentary, lived from 1040 to 1105. I don't know that that's so significant. He was an incredible individual. He died at the age of 65, lived in Worms and in Provence, if I'm not mistaken. He wrote a commentary on the entire five books, on the prophets, on the writings, on the Talmud, on the Mishnah. Okay? And he died at 65. His system of commentary is an interesting one. He believes that the challenge is to try to understand the verse from its context. The contextual understanding. Do things make sense within their context? And he quotes all sorts of different things, Medrash. We'll get back to this when we look at Medrash. Very valuable commentary. And a good one to begin with. If you decide that you want to start working on commentary, studying with Rashi is a tremendous tool. The Ramban. Much more difficult. By the way, Rashi has been translated into English. And you can find Rashi in English. If anybody chooses to look for it here, you can remind me afterwards and I'll show you where it is. The Ramban. Rav Moshe ben Nachman, and this is a special place for me because Rav Moshe ben Nachman ended up coming to the land of Israel, right near here. He started a synagogue on the Mount of Zion, which was then destroyed but continued here in the central square. You can go to the Ramban synagogue. If some of you go on Shprinzi's synagogue tour on Shabbat morning, which I highly advise you to go on, I think she's going to take you there. So ask her to tell you more about the Ramban. But the Ramban ended up teaching and studying and walking right where we're learning, right in this area. Because this building was built before the Ramban came here. No. No, the Ramban came here in 1265, 1266. So this was probably under construction then. So I'm willing to bet he got here. So to study the Ramban when he got it. Now there's also a brilliant translation of the Ramban. As a matter of fact, this is one of the rare instances where I'll tell a person to read even an English translation of the Ramban, and not just the Ramban. You see that blue set on the bottom shelf over there? That's a set of the writings of the Ramban, at least on the commentary on the Bible, edited by a guy named Chevel, tremendous Torah scholar. And he's also a very valuable commentary. I wouldn't get to the Ramban before I've had some experience with Rashi. That's like a later stage, right? There are a lot of other Torah commentaries. I will mention one more that's really, really valuable. Because I think that from an ethical perspective, what he does with the verses is tremendous. This is a much later commentary. 19th century German commentator called Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. Tremendous, tremendous commentary on the Torah. Makes it come alive. Now his language is very flowery. So you have to sort of get past that sometimes because the English translation was done early enough in this century that that was the way they wrote. But a very valuable read. And sometimes, if you think Rashi is difficult, you can even begin from Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. Because he'll often quote Rashi and he'll give you a sense. If anybody here is curious about the Bible and more commentaries, you can come over and talk to me. It'd be a pleasure. I would highly advise you to go through the shelves here. You'll find other things that are of interest to you. Okay. Now, I wanted to take a look, okay, at a text. Just for a few moments. And get a chance to get a sense of studying Torah. Now, I'll be honest with you, the reason that I focused in this particular class and other classes in the Jewish book series, we're going to do this a little more, less, is because we're going to be studying Chumash in our course in ethics, starting the next class. So don't be nervous if you feel you wanted more of a text of studying Bible, because you'll get a taste of it, and then some as we go on in the other course. But really what I'm looking to do, to be honest with you, is to give you a few tips. I mean, let's assume for the moment, you know, everybody here is from different backgrounds. But let's take the common denominator. Let's assume that somebody here has never opened up a Bible before. Has never even heard much about the Bible. Till today. And let's say that somebody walks away from here and says, well, for the people of the book, and, you know, if that's who we are, I'm curious. So how do you go about doing it? I mean, do you just read a commentary? Is that what gets people so excited about this? So I want to give you a sense of how this could be, and maybe some tips in how to go about doing this. Okay? And I just want to look at one quick story. And this is a story that I want you to read very briefly. Second chapter of Genesis, verse 18 to verse 24. I once had a student who came over to me. I gave a lecture on faith. And it was such an involved discussion. Is there a God? Can you find God? How do you go about finding God? And he comes over to me at the end of the class. And he says, what's the question? What's the answer? What's the answer? What's the answer? What's the question? Give out! So what's the question? And I want to tell you something else. If I study a text and something bothers me, then that's going to make me want to find an answer. That doesn't mean it's so easy to find an answer. But if nothing bothers me about the text, then I'm just reading it. If you read this text, something should bother you. So what bothers you here? Just out of curiosity. What questions do you have? Now let's learn. What bothers you? What questions? Yeah.
Why is God able to make a companion for him first off without having to make the animals?
Yeah, okay, that's well. Now you just asked one question and alluded to another. Okay? Well, why can't... What's this whole animal thing here? You know, it's almost as though God says, well, we need a mate for man. Check out all the animals. Maybe you'll find a good one. You know, would you like an elephant? Well, you know, I'd have to get too much furniture. You know, there'd be no room. Well, would you like a giraffe? Well, you know, how am I going to kiss her? It'd be terrible, you know? I mean, what kind of a king-size bed do I need if I marry a hippo? So Adam looks through the animals. He can't find one. So God says, all right, you can't find a good animal. You know, that'd be good. So take a woman. You know, okay. That's a wonderful commentary on relationships. Is that what the Torah is trying to tell me?
Yeah, I was wondering what the help meant.
Yeah, I mean, well, what is that? It's like, listen, you know, a horse. Horse will carry all your stuff for you. Dog, be a faithful animal. I don't know, this woman, I don't know. But all right, she's the next best thing to an animal. Is that what the Torah is telling me? Now you can imagine, since I'm happily married, that's not my opinion, right? And I don't think that's at all what the Torah, but that should bother you. And I want to go you one further. The issue is not whether you find the answer right now. Sometimes it takes years to find a good answer. We're an impatient people. How you decide when you need to find the answer then, and when you have to be patient, well, that's an interesting question, that's a larger discussion. But sometimes I'll be studying the Talmud, and I'll be in a difficult tractate, and something will bother me, and I'll discuss it with my study partner, or whoever it is, whatever. I don't always find a good answer, but I want to remember the question. And I write it down, and I review it, and every time I come across that, I review the question again. And sometimes, you know, you'll be sitting years later. I remember once I was teaching class, and someone asked me a question, and led to another question, and all of a sudden, that's the answer! And they couldn't figure it out. And I said, you know, there's this question that was bothering me about this particular mission or whatever in Brachot, and I never found an answer, but based on what you just said, well, now I got an answer! Took me 10 years to find an answer, but I got the answer. And sometimes you can be discussing something totally differently. You're in this verse, and you remember a question you had from years earlier, and that's tremendous. You have to have an answer right away. That's how life works. No. But the value of a question. And I want you to know, I have a relationship with that Mishnah, developed over years because of that question. And by the way, imagine for the moment the experiences in your life where you've been given a quick answer. Do they really mean something? Do they last? Do you remember them? And those instances in your life where you had a question and you struggled with it and you grappled with it and you searched for it and you finally found an answer, that answer is yours forever. So there's a tremendous value to a question. By the way, I'll tell you one more thing. There are different types of questions. And it's worth realizing there are different types of questions, because once you realize what different types of questions they are, you learn to look for them. For example, there are questions of context. What is this doing next to this? At the end of the story of Mount Sinai, of the giving of the Ten Commandments, all of a sudden it starts talking about the sabbatical year. Every seventh year the land should lie fallow. What does Shemitah have to do with Har Sinai? What does the sabbatical year have to do with Mount Sinai? As a matter of fact, this is such a famous question in the Bible that in modern Hebrew, this is a phrase, an idiom, that's used to mean, what the heck are you talking about? If you're in the bus station, right? And someone says, you know, what time is the bus to Tel Aviv? And you say to them, oh, Tel Aviv, you're going to Tel Aviv is a magnificent place. And they say to you, my Shemitah itzel Har Sinai. What does Shemitah have to do with Mount Sinai? And you're like, wow. So there's a contextual question. And sometimes you have a philosophical question. Give me a good philosophical question on this verse. Right? On verse 18. Good philosophical question with a lot of meat. Very difficult question. And God says, verse 18. Pardon?
Coffee,
Why does who need help? Why does man need help?
Yeah.
That's a very good question.
Like
there you go. I mean, who created man? God created man, right? And God says now, it's not good that man's alone, right? Why isn't it good that man's alone? God created man. Everything God creates is good, right? So how could it be not good? So you're right. Why does man need a helpmate? And if man does need a helpmate, why doesn't God create man as a helpmate originally? That's a very deep question. How could God look at something God did and say, oh, this is not good? How could anything God did be not good? That's a very difficult philosophical question. And we're not going to answer it here. But it should bother you. How could you sit and read that verse and not be bothered? How could you stay in your chair? Give out! What's going on? I had a Rebbe used to tell me, you should fly out of your chair! He's right. That's learning. I'll give you another example. Right? What are the animals, this is really a follow-up to what you were saying, David, what are the animals doing here in the middle? Why doesn't it just say, man saw all the animals, and he named all the animals. And then God saw, because man named the animals, and every animal had a pair, that man wanted a pair too. He wanted a buddy. Which would make a lot of sense to me, by the way. You could argue that the issue is not that man needed a partner, but that man needed a partner once man wanted a partner. You could even go so far as to say, and I believe this very deeply, that it was a very good thing that man began alone. And this is our life, oh, we have to stop. This is our life process. That we begin alone. And the more we go through in our struggle to find that person that we wish to share our life with, the more ultimately we'll appreciate them. Right? My brother, Bezrat Hashem, is getting married in June. And he was divorced at a young age. Made a big mistake. It was a long story. Baruch Hashem, I want you to know, he appreciates what he has. And I've never seen him so happy. And it's wonderful. Baruch Hashem. So that's tremendous. But you can't get to that thought unless you've first had that question. It has to bother you. Perhaps one of the messages here is that God is teaching us that woman is not an animal. Maybe it's valuable that man has to go through this process and see how animals relate to each other and realize himself that that's not going to do it. That he needs an ezer kenegdo. He needs a partner. He needs a person who can be productive and non-productive. A person who can compliment him. Who can disagree with him. Tremendous idea. It's a partnership. It's not just a physical union. That's a mistake that we make very often. Rabbi Aaron discusses this in his book to great length. You know, we think we're falling in love. It's a weird expression, falling in love. What does it mean to fall in love? We make a mistake. We have this image of what love is. We want to find that perfect person. And we don't realize very often that love is a function of relationship. It's a function of work. People think, now I found the perfect person. The work is over. Ah, the work is just beginning. It's tremendous to develop a relationship. And that's all here. But I want you to know it begins with the questions. Now let me give you a couple of quick tips, since we're on the topic and studying Bible, and then we have to break for lunch. Okay? And there's a lot more to this story, you can imagine. But if I whet your appetite and you're curious, okay. So first of all, I mentioned to you the value of a question. Now I want to tell you, there are a few practical issues that I just wanted to mention. First of all, where do you begin? And again, you know, I'm not saying everybody should go out here, grab a Bible, and begin studying Bible. But if you want to, you know, it wouldn't bother me if you walked away and you weren't ready to start, or there are other things, there are so many different things you can do. But what would kill me is if you decide you want to start, and you don't know what to do. So at least I'll give you a couple of tips. Obviously, this is a lot more, you know. First of all, people make a common mistake. They figure, I'm going to study Bible. Where should I start?
Beginning.
Big mistake. Big mistake. Because you figure, great, I'm going to start at the beginning. And I'm going to, you know, begin to read. And I'll take a commentary. And I'll, you know, do some reading with a commentary. I'll read it. Then I'll go back and learn it. Things will bother me. They'll bother me enough. I'll try to think of my own answers, which, by the way, is a very valuable process. Before you look to commentaries to find out what they say, analyze it, see if you can come up with your own answers. Sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. Sometimes you'll realize in the course of your study that your theory is completely wrong. But every now and then you'll find a theory and you'll have an answer and you'll suggest something and you'll think about it. And then you'll find it in a comment that'll blow your mind. That's, by the way, a great way of realizing that you're getting somewhere.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.